Okay, may it please the court, Robert Forquist, registration number 19577, representing the defendant appellant Michael Carton, who is appealing an order from the Douglas District Court denying his motion for post-conviction relief under Rule 35C without an evidentiary hearing. Because the panel is familiar with the case from having read the briefs in this case, and the briefs set out the procedural and relevant factual history of the case, I'm going to dispense with going over that, just cut to the arguments. Also, we've briefed three issues in our opening brief. I want to focus this afternoon on the first and second issues. We're not abandoning or withdrawing the third issue. We'll just rely on what's in the brief, unless the panel has any questions on that. All right. There's one sentence in Ardolino versus People, which I think is really critical in this case, and that is where Justice Coates said that, and I'm just going to read that one sentence because I think it really sums up what we're here today. The sentence is as follows. At least where the defendant was able to identify seemingly unusual or misguided actions by his counsel and plausible options for the defense of his client that counsel did not pursue, the defendant could not be deprived of an opportunity to prove those choices lacked any sound strategic motive, unless the existing record clearly established otherwise, or those choices could not have prejudiced in any event. And that's from Ardolino 69, Pacific 3rd, page 79. And the reason I focus on that is basically what we're here for today is not to argue that the 35C motion should have been granted or denied. It's whether my client was entitled to an evidentiary hearing based upon what was pleaded in that motion. We submit that there was enough that was pleaded to warrant an evidentiary hearing. If I can discuss the first issue raised in our opening brief, that's the question of whether the post-conviction court properly denied Mr. Carton's claim that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to properly raise a Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause objection to introduction of the videotape of HS's forensic interview at the Sungate Center. And as counsel for the people pointed out in his answer brief, and I think I addressed it in my reply, the sequence of events that happened was my client was arrested and charged in 2002. His case went to trial in autumn of 2003. At the time of trial, Ohio versus Roberts would have been the controlling case law governing a Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause objection. Our case went to trial in fall of 2003. The Crawford case, Crawford versus Washington, was decided in the spring of 2004. The Court of Appeals on the direct appeal in this case decided this case in 2005. So had trial counsel cited the Sixth Amendment and cited Ohio versus Roberts, that would have at least preserved the issue so that counsel on the direct appeal would have been able to raise the Crawford issue. It's our position that trial counsel, it was incumbent upon trial counsel to constitutionalize the claim that the videotape should not have been allowed in. Whether it was under Ohio versus Roberts and then later argued on appeal, Crawford, the important part is, and this is something that is really basic, and I remember being taught this when I took criminal procedure in law school, is that you constitutionalize issues if there is a good faith argument can be made. So it's our position that, that allegation in the motion was sufficient to warrant, at least on the first claim, a hearing. We also have an offer of proof as to what trial counsel would have said had he been called to testify at a 35C hearing. He believes he was ineffective. The people point out correctly that that's not conclusive, and we're not saying that it has to be conclusive. It was some evidence. It was some evidence that the court could have heard at a 35C hearing. And the people could have cross-examined trial counsel and asked him, what was your strategic motive for not raising a Sixth Amendment claim?
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Borquez, if I may, please.
Certainly not.
I'm wondering what a hearing really would have gained your client. Haven't you really structured this as a legal issue? And the legal issue is, well, this was a Crawford issue, and it should have been preserved as a Crawford issue. And if it had been, my client would have been successful on his direct appeal. I don't understand what additional facts there were that would have helped your client in this regard? Could you explain, please?
There is a legal issue here, Your Honor. That's correct, but there's also a factual dispute here about that. And I understand that the people are taking the position that this was not ineffective assistance. In fact, I think the trial or the post-conviction court in the order denying the 35C motion said that the defendant has not made out a prima facie case that this was ineffective assistance. I think that was the language used. I do think that there's a legal question here, but there's also a factual issue presented. And that's whether this was ineffective assistance or not.
Well, isn't ultimately the conclusion of whether it is ineffective assistance a legal question?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think that there has to be a certain amount of evidence. The post-conviction court acts as a fact finder on whether there's sufficient evidence that this was ineffective assistance. Ineffective assistance is analogous to a malpractice claim. And I think that we're dealing with a mixed question of fact and law here because there's a standard that has to be met in order for a defense attorney to meet the Sixth Amendment effective assistance obligation. But whether the facts meet that threshold or not presents a factual question. We have Mr. Fielder saying that I don't believe I was effective here. We have the people saying that, you know, that's not sufficient. But I think that there is a factual and a legal question presented here, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Is it your position that the triable issue for ineffective assistance was failure to anticipate Crawford or failure to make a good faith objection under Roberts?
The latter, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. I didn't mean to snap at you. What would be the good faith basis for having objected under Roberts?
Okay, under Ohio versus Roberts, if I recall correctly, there are two things that would have to be established to keep the hearsay out. To get the hearsay admitted, you have to show unavailability of the declarant.
I'm not disputing that,
correct.
Okay.
The trial court had found that HS was not competent to testify. The second prong has to do with the indicia of reliability requirement. And I think that a good faith argument could have been made if that wasn't established for a couple of reasons. There was, number one, the Sunday interview was an ex parte interview. There was no opportunity for cross-examination. This isn't like trying to introduce a deposition or preliminary hearing transcript where there may have been cross-examination. Number two, there were some inconsistencies in what HS said between what she said to her parents, the initial outcry, and then what she said at Sungate. And I think that an argument could have been made that this negates the indicia of reliability problem of Ohio versus Roberts.
Was the video admitted under the child hearsay statute?
I believe so.
Aren't the indicia of the circumstantial indicia of reliability essentially the same under the child hearsay statute than as under Roberts and the pre-Crawford view?
The question wasn't preserved like that, Your Honor. That's where the issue is. So what happened was the issue was basically forfeited by not being constitutionalized.
Well, did counsel challenge the admissibility under the child hearsay statute for insufficient circumstantial indicia of trustworthiness?
He did object, raise a hearsay objection.
Okay.
All right. I don't remember his exact words, but I do remember there was the evidentiary objection was raised, the constitutional claim was not. That I do remember. If I can.
Counsel, I'm sorry, we're still talking about that. I don't remember, and maybe I'm misremembering, but in the post-conviction motion, was there an argument about Ohio v. Roberts? I don't remember seeing one.
No, and in fact, I don't believe my predecessor who drafted the motion cited, he referred to the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause. I don't remember if he cited, well, I've got it right here. I can look very quickly.
And particularly my question is then, if it's not raised in the post-conviction motion, is it something we should be considering on appeal?
I think that the Sixth Amendment was raised both in the post-conviction motion and in my opening brief and in my reply brief, and the people addressed racist in their answer brief. So the Sixth Amendment is mentioned, I think it's on
And we can look at that. That's fine. I wasn't remembering that specifically argued Ohio v. Roberts and that counsel was ineffective for not lodging an objection under Ohio.
He mentions the Sixth Amendment, no case law.
Okay.
And that's on page 11 of the post-trial or post-conviction relief motion. I've got 4 minutes, so let me try to launch into the second issue I wanted to discuss.
Please do.
And that has to do with whether the post-conviction court erred in denying the motion to the extent it raised the claim that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to retain and call an expert in forensic interviewing techniques. And my recollection is that the post-conviction court rejected that claim on the prejudice. It rejected and found that there was no prejudice. It didn't address whether it was ineffective assistance or not to call such an expert. But the post-conviction court said, and I just want to read these two sentences, even if trial counsel had retained an expert in forensic interviewing to question the credibility of the interview with the victim. However, the prosecution had also presented statements the victims made to their parents and grandmother. All right. I believe I pointed out in our brief that that was a big part of the defense. In other words, the grandmother, who was my client's now ex-wife, was, they were having marital issues back at the time, and the mother of the two children, they were biased. That was, I think, brought out at trial. I think it was mentioned in our brief. So they're not entirely unimpeachable, disinterested witnesses. The other part of the post-conviction order says, for the most part, the statements made by the victims were spontaneous. They were repeated, and they were made within a relatively short time after the babysitting incident. There were statements made, but it's our position that there were some inconsistencies in some of the statements that the children made. There were facts that were added later on at the Sungate interview that weren't mentioned earlier on. And there's the whole question of whether there was leading questions during the forensic interview or not. So it's our position that a forensic interviewing expert, such as Detective Mose, from the former detective from the Fort Collins Police Department, would have been able to point out, you know, this is inappropriate forensic interviewing techniques. And I think that it would have undermined the credibility of the declarants. So, unless there are any other questions, we would ask that this panel reverse the summary denial of the 35C motion, send us back for a hearing, and let Mr. Carton have his day in court. Unless there are any questions, I've reserved the remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Burrell?
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, registration number 17846. And I represent the people in this matter. I wanted to just start by mentioning the standards under which a 35C motion are reviewed by the trial court, which is that the motion must set forth facts that, if true, would entitle the defendant to relief. And in the context of an ineffective assistance claim, essentially those facts have to satisfy the two prongs of the Strickland test, which is that first, counsel's performance was deficient, and that is that counsel failed to perform within the prevailing standards of minimally acceptable conduct as of the time of the challenged conduct. And second, the second prong is the prejudice to the defense. And the defendant must show that there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceedings would have been different. Turning to the first issue, The court correctly found that the defendant had not made a sufficient showing that his counsel's performance had been deficient in the motion. And I just wanted to jump right into, I guess, the discussion of Ohio versus Roberts versus the Crawford test. And Mr. Borquez is correct that the claim that was raised in the 35C motion is simply a Sixth Amendment claim. It doesn't address Ohio versus Roberts, or maybe more importantly, set forth facts under Ohio versus Roberts as to why counsel was ineffective for raising the claim. But probably more importantly, the assertion as to trial counsel's belief about why he was ineffective go to the Crawford claim. And that is, council says, and it's presented in a somewhat conclusory fashion, the council essentially says that if he had raised the claim, then, and they don't explain how, he would have been able to have a preserved claim for his direct appeal and would have gotten a new trial. That claim is based on the fact that Crawford came out subsequently. So if anything, the assertion goes to a claim that he should have preserved a claim in anticipation of Crawford coming out, which of course he couldn't have known would happen. And I think that goes to the very first prong of the Strickland test, which is the Strickland test says that we measure counsel's performance based on the standards at the time that the conduct took place, counsel's alleged error took place. And we have good case law in this state that says that, of course, counsel can't foresee material changes in the law. And I think it's clear here that counsel could not have foreseen Crawford. The Crawford was a major change. As Mr. Borquez talked about, Ohio versus Roberts had a two-prong test based on unavailability of a witness, and I think that's clear here. And then whether there's any issue of reliability to support the introduction of the statement. And Judge White, I know you asked the question, and my recollection, which is very general, is that counsel did challenge the hearsay statement. I can't remember the specifics of what his particular argument was, but I think it's the It's the Diefenderfer case, which talks about the comparison between the child hearsay statute and the Ohio versus Roberts test. I was just looking at it before argument, and my recollection is that what it says is actually the statute provides more protection than the confrontation clause analysis under Ohio versus Roberts. So I would assume that it would, that if it passed the hearsay test, that it also passes Ohio versus Roberts. But I feel like I'm going in circles. So coming back around again, the fundamental point is that counsel, the defendant in his 35C motion did not allege Ohio versus Roberts facts to show why counsel should have raised the claim in the first instance. So there, it's simply conclusory, which I think is what the trial court ultimately held in rejecting that claim, was that they just didn't show that there was a deficient performance there. Go right on to the forensic expert issue next. The trial court here found and was correct that, again, the defendant's allegations weren't sufficient to show that counsel had engaged in a deficient performance in failing to hire an expert in forensic interviews. And the court pointed out that this was so given that the victims made statements that were spontaneous and repeated and made within a short time of the incident to family members. So that these statements were coming in. And then the court goes on to mention that jurors are perfectly able to assess whether language of a child in an interview is age appropriate or not. So you really don't need an expert to tell them whether that's so. But I wanted to talk briefly about trial strategy in this context, because I think that's, in essence, what the court is talking about here, is that here you have an interview statement of a child, and then you have these out-of-court statements that are made to family members. And so if you call an expert to challenge essentially the interview by the expert, what you're doing is highlighting in detail the victim's statements. And you're asking on cross-examination by the prosecution not only for your witness to be carefully examined about those, their assessment of the statements, but then to point out that there are all other consistent statements made by those same victims in another context, and ask them to explain how those fit together. And so all you're doing is re-emphasizing an area in the testimony that you may really not want to highlight. And so I think that's well within the trial strategy of counsel to make that decision.
How can we decide that in the absence of an evidentiary hearing?
Well, I think
we don't know. The defendant may be able to march in six expert witnesses who'd say that was idiocy. and the people may not be able to find one who would disagree, and the converse is equally true. So, you know, how can we decide that on a, without a hearing?
Well, I think the answer to that question lies in the test that's provided for the trial court's initial review of the 35C, which is, and it sounds like I'm going on and on again, but does the motion set forth facts that demonstrate that the defendant is entitled to relief? And the facts that are set forth in the motion simply say he would have called this expert and she would have challenged, here's what she would have testified to. She would have challenged the fact that some of the questions were leading and that apparently some language was age inappropriate without much specification. The assertions that go to the prejudice prong, which they have to prove both, are simply that, and that if counsel had consulted an expert, he would have been, quote, more prepared to cross-examine the witness who interviewed the victims, and that the expert could have, quote, attacked the poor forensic interviews. Those are conclusory allegations. I think that the answer, perhaps, to your question is, in the first instance, we asked that the defendant set forth the facts. He doesn't necessarily have to show how we would have proven them, but he has to set forth sufficient facts to show that, but for counsel's alleged error, the outcome would have been different. And that's essentially where we start with this. And it is that obligation to conduct a proper investigation or sufficient investigation to make those factual allegations in the motion, and they simply aren't sufficient here. So I think the defendant first has to get over that hurdle before he's entitled to an evidentiary hearing on the claim. And here, as the trial court essentially found, these aren't sufficient to show either deficient performance or prejudice to the defense in this case. And I just wanted to comment on something which I don't think I really talked about in the brief, but in the context of this expert's assertions that were set forth in the motion, they mentioned that the expert said that in her opinion, it was highly irregular for child victims to accuse adults of focusing on the child's breasts in an assault because children essentially don't have breasts. And I just wanted to point out why that's not enough in this particular fact scenario to get anywhere, because if you look in the opening brief, there's a statement of the probation officer's testimony. The probation officer's testimony for the defendant, if you recall, the defendant was convicted of an offense involving his niece. And the probation officer testified that between the ages of 7 and 13, the niece's age of 7 and 13, the defendant admitted to fondling her breasts. So again, this is the kind of fact that only highlights some other evidence that seems to counter the opinion of the expert. So I don't think that evidence gets us anywhere in showing the prejudice prong of the two-part Strickland test. I think that's all I have, unless there are some other questions. I would thank the court for its time. Thank you.
Just very briefly, Your Honor, I want to touch upon one or two things that Mr. Holman raised in his argument. And I want to start with, and Judge Webb's question was right on point with this, and that is, Mr. Holman has put out there what is could arguably be a strategic reason not to call the expert, Detective Mose, to testify, and that is, it might highlight this particular aspect of the prosecution's case. However, as Your Honor pointed out, you can't deal with that in an appeal. In other words, right now, that speculation that the prosecution could have found an expert to say that. And as Your Honor pointed out, the defense could present an expert who's going to say that makes, you know, that is not sound strategy. And that's the heart of why our client should have had an evidentiary hearing on this issue. Any questions?
Counsel, if we assume that maybe those allegations were sufficient on performance, what about the allegations with respect to prejudice? That the cross-examination might have been better or could have been better?
On the second issue, on the failure to use the expert?
Yes.
And on prejudice there? Well, what we have, Your Honor, is We have a videotape of the younger child, HS. We have no live testimony of her. We have her initial statement to her mom and dad, and we have her Sungate interview, which is, there's some differences. Other details were revealed. And then we have the older child. And the older child basically gave the interview at Sungate, and then later on was called to testify and didn't recall any of this. That's shaky, all right? That's shaky, her testimony. I think that when you have shaky testimony and you've got a forensic interviewer who asks, in her own words, directed questions to keep the child focused, I think she said, because especially the two-year-old, her mind would wander, she had to keep her focused. And we have Detective Moe saying that these were leading questions. I think that because the evidence was not overwhelming, that there was enough that had this witness been called, it could have changed the outcome of the case. That's our position. Any other questions?
Nope.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.